This is GeekSpeak, recorded live at KUSP Studios, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from T. Rowe Price, managing investments for the long term with a consistent, disciplined approach. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. 800-541-6002.
It is Saturday, May 19th, 2007, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. Today on GeekSpeak, our Week in Geek News segment and your questions and comments of technology. It's time now for GeekSpeak.
We're through being cool. We're through being cool. Eliminate the ninnies and the twits.
And welcome to GeekSpeak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during GeekSpeak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on GeekSpeak, we're doing geek news for the first half, and in the second half, we're taking your questions with comments and questions about technology, anything you'd like. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can contact us right now. Just go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. Tomorrow evening at 7, KUSP presents Another View with host Paul Couture. Another View brings you news, voices, and opinions you won't hear in the mainstream media. This week, a look at the populist economic policies of President Hugo Chavez. That's Another View, Sundays at 7, right here on Central Coast Public Radio. GeekSpeak on Central Coast Public Radio KUSP is supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is GeekSpeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Miles Elam, a Slacker geek and student.
Good morning.
And Ryder Brooks, technical account manager at SCO.
Hey, Lyle.
Hi. Thank you, geeks, for being here today. We also have support geeks. Alex Leas just signed on through AIM, through Instant Messenger. And, of course, Rick Philman is taking our calls in the second half. Before we get calls in the second half, let's do some week news. News in the week, geek news. Yeah, that's what it is. Miles, what's going on in tech this week?
First of all, the FCC is looking to redefine broadband. Broadband right now is what everybody knows is your cable connection or your DSL connection. However, what was considered very fast when the term broadband was first introduced back, 7 years ago, 8 years ago, isn't what's fast today. In other words, the current regulation is broadband is defined as anything faster than 200 kilobits a second, which anyone who has a 384 kilobit per second DSL line, in other words, your base DSL line that you can possibly get, will fit that criteria. But they've been finding that over time now our needs are growing, how much web pages are getting heavier because of the amount of people that have faster and faster speeds. So they're looking at changing the definition of broadband to be 2 megabits a second as a minimum basis.
That's a good speed.
A minimum basis for advertising as well.
Let me ask you, why does the FCC need to define this term? Because people market it?
Well, they're also trying to figure out how many people have access. They're changing a lot of different things. For example, one of them is speed. The other one is having to do with how many households in America have broadband access. And what they had done previously was just check to see by zip code. Unfortunately, that hasn't worked out too well because there could be one or two people in an entire zip code that have access to broadband access, and therefore they count the entire zip code.
Oh, I see.
And so they're looking to change that and try to narrow it down, trying to tighten it up.
So why will this help them do that?
Why will
redefining the spec to be larger help them narrow down?
Well, there are two different things. One is checking penetration, and that's that zip code issue. The other one is the fact that other countries are so much faster than we are that it's becoming embarrassing. Not just an embarrassment in terms of, his is bigger than mine, more along the lines of we could lose a competitive edge, people's access to YouTube and technologies like that. If other people have a greater amount of bandwidth, then they have a greater availability to media and content.
New services and possibly even development tools. So we're definitely falling behind the race, if you will, to high-speed access. And one of the statistics, of course, you look at is how broadband is. But the truth is other countries' broadband is so much better than ours that when we compare broadband, we're actually comparing apples to oranges. So we're trying to redefine the term broadband such that we then are more comparable to other companies that have high-speed access.
Or other countries, yes. For example, something South Korea is anywhere between 10 megabits and 100 megabits a second to the home.
So what's the difference in what you mentioned before is 200 kilobits per second is the what's the now
is
definition?
Is the current definition.
And 2 megabits. So that's only a factor of 10. Is that correct in that? So it's 10 times faster is the new definition.
I don't know about only 10 times faster being... I mean, 10 times faster is still a
10
lot
times faster. And then South Korea's base is 10 megabits?
The average is mm-hmm. anywhere between 10 and higher. France recently put up a service that allows for 20 megabit.
Can you get DSL at 10 megabit? Is the spec good enough to perform that high?
Unfortunately, I don't believe it is. The fastest I've ever seen DSL is 6. Cable I've seen at 8.
600?
No, 6 megabits.
Uh-huh.
Cable I've seen at 8. Once you go faster than that, most of the time, the only time I've seen it was with fiber optic.
Or LAN or Ethernet and such, right?
Right. But I'm talking about that last mile because Ethernet doesn't work for the phone company to your house or the cable company to your
house. Because they haven't installed it, yeah. All right.
Well, no, I mean distances.
Ethernet. I'm sorry. Yeah. Ethernet. Yeah, I thought you meant fiber. Okay, well, so redefinition, is going to help us get a better edge on high-speed access? Is this going to
help? That's what we're hoping that, or at least it'll become prioritized. And also, it would allow for the advertising, say, I have a broadband line. It keeps the companies from selling services that are that slow. It ups the ante.
Okay, but what about existing customers? They think they have broadband. The new definition shows that actually they don't have broadband. How's the cable company or the DSL company going to say new broadband? Are they going to label it? Is it going to be a marketing label that we're going to see? Has that emerged?
Well,
super fast
broadband.
For
existing customers, they'll probably just be a bit more hush about it.
Yeah.
And then you'll have marketing terms talking about you have a broadband connection, then you have
super
broadband. Enhanced internet, that type of thing.
Sure. Right.
To add a comment to that, I was recently talking to a technician that was helping me for my local provider DSL, and he'd sort of, I was inquiring because I have a cap on my internet speed. I'm too far away from the phone company to mm-hmm. get really any faster, and I was inquiring with him, are you going to be improving any of the technology in my area so I can get faster bandwidth? And he says, probably not. He says as is, because of the competitiveness with the pricing of DSL, that he said that residential DSL is not profitable for the phone companies, at least the one that I use. And he says that they make all their money off of business mm-hmm. DSL and bandwidth. So it's kind of interesting that, that they're increasing all the bandwidth targeting presumably residential users, because that's most people. But maybe the adoption rate is not that high because it's not profitable for the companies to do that.
Maybe a new definition will have to come with a better price as well, so that they can make a profit on putting the infrastructure.
Well, presumably, the faster speed you want, the more you're willing to pay for it.
Yeah.
Baseline, providers that do fiber optics to the home, they seem to be pretty competitive,
That seems odd to me just on its face because they're saying, it's not profitable in this area. And yet telecom and cable companies have fought tooth and nail to keep municipal broadband. In other words, government sanctioned, like a local municipality setting up their own internet connection as a base level. And they've been saying, no, this is anti-competitive. But if it's a loss leader, then who cares if they're working it off of businesses?
I think there's a difference when you're good question. I don't know.
It seems like they have two arguments that are opposed to one another there.
You're listening to Geek Speak. That's Miles Elam. Ryder Brooks is also here. I'm Lyle Troxell, and we're doing Geek News. And Ryder, next story is yours.
Okay. So I thought it was pretty interesting. Microsoft spent a lot of money recently on buying an interactive ad agency called Aquantive. And they spent $6 billion on this thing.
I hope they got something for $6 billion.
What's $6 billion buy?
it buys you a big company. Well, actually, not that big. Only 2,600 people, and there were three children companies to it. I think that's not small, though. It's not small, but that's for $6 billion. That's a lot. They recently got outbid by Google last month for another ad agency that they bought for, I believe, about $2 billion or $3.5 billion.
This might have been a bidding war for this company.
It is a competitive thing. I think they're trying to buy up all the competition for that.
And what are these companies doing, the one that Google bought and this
The one that Google bought, I believe, is called DoubleClick.
Oh, DoubleClick's huge.
Yeah.
Sure. That's right. I recall that story. So these are basically marketing, internet marketing companies.
Yeah.
Aquantis the same type of company?
It's a little bit more. They're buying a technology. It's a suite.
What I was thinking is when you said that earlier before when we were set up for the show, I was like, what? That doesn't make any sense to me. And then I was realized, well, patents are things you can own and they're pretty important. So it's possible this company, of course, has some patents. And that's what Microsoft's actually buying.
Yes, and that's actually another news too. Microsoft
is,
I don't have all the details on that, unfortunately, but they're threatening Google, the Linux kernel itself. Microsoft is doing this. Recently, Linus Torvalds. Did you pronounce his last name?
Linus Torvalds.
Okay, I'm a bad Linux fan. he basically said, put up.
I haven't met him either.
he said, put up or shut up.
Give us a foundation of what's going on. What's Microsoft suing Linux for? I mean, isn't Linux a free open source thing?
Well,
how can Microsoft do that?
They are suing basically for patent infringement. But they're not declaring. They said approximately 235 patent infringements that they're claiming. The Linux kernel, I don't have all the other sources.
Yeah,
have they actually sued? I know that they were publishing it.
They're offering leniency to
they're
corporations.
They're threatening to sue.
They're offering an indemnity to it, which is odd considering if there is actually a patent problem, then this has been going on long enough that you would think, okay, well, show us what's wrong so that they can fix it or so they can pay restitution or whatever. And yet they're dragging it out without saying exactly what patents are actually infringed.
Right. And I think Linus actually said, I'd like to do the workaround, so I'd like to get rid of the patents if there's patents infringement.
Actually, Linus Torvalds was a lot more critical than that.
He was. He actually said, that's great. We're open source kernel. Everyone can review our code and point out flaws where we might be violating patents or intellectual property rights. But Microsoft, you probably are the prime, violator of this because you have such a huge code base and we can't see it.
We don't know if you're violating patents.
Even more so, Linus Torvalds was actually saying that all of the interesting patents having to do with operating systems were owned by IBM and have since fallen out because IBM patented them back in the 60s.
Right.
So they're saying exactly what? Because it's an operating system. It's not.
Well, it's also one of those things where when you deal with a Linux, when Microsoft says there's all these infringements and you talk about Linux, it's very possible that Microsoft's talking about most of the installs of Linux, and most of the installs of Linux also have all these other add-on applications like KDE and stuff. And it might be that Microsoft saying, the color picker in KDE is ours, or we own some patent on that. And that's not actually Linux core. So there's that kind of situation as well.
But at the same time, they're being very vague about it. It's kind of watch out, this might be a problem, without actually saying, here's the problem.
Now, I read a bit about this and kind of agree with the idea that corporations basically, they all own patents, and they lease each other access to their patents by doing kind of trading. It's like, this is our patent portfolio, and there's your patent portfolio. Let's just be able to use each other's patents for free. And, of course, anyone that doesn't own patents can't really play that game. And so this is one of those kind of maneuvers of Microsoft's potentially. Anyway, let's go on to another news story. Miles, are you want to take the next one, sir?
Sure. There's a case where Congress is looking, or rather the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, is
currently Attorney General.
Is asking Congress to make attempted copyright infringement a federal crime. And
excuse me?
Right.
How do you attempt to copyright infringe?
Well, I was thinking along the lines of, because this has to do with movies, downloading of movies and music and the like. trying to get it. In other words, you put in a search in LimeWire to see which things you can get, and even if you get a result back or not, you tried to infringe. You tried to get that music for free.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say slippery slope?
Yeah. I mean, that doesn't work at all. I mean, I'm in a research institution, and that's one of the things we do is take a look at what the trends are, and you have to get data to do that. So right there, it makes sense to me that you should be able to search and investigate things and not necessarily take the line of, you know, what you might perceive as piracy, but get up to very close to it.
And at the same time, I could totally see them saying, oh, we'll make an exception for
for educational institutions
doing actual research.
Sure.
Of course, for the general student body, they'd probably still drop the hammer.
All right. Well, thank you, Miles, on that.
So, if that seems kind of odd to you, it seems as odd to our audience as it does to those of us in this room, by all means, contact your local Congress critter.
Writer?
So in gaming news today, Blizzard announced, now Blizzard is the developer of the massively popular World of Warcraft online game. They just announced today that StarCraft II is going to be in development. And
Miles, had you heard that story that StarCraft II is in development?
Yes, I had seen it.
Okay. So it's pretty exciting, I got to say. I asked Miles about it because Miles and I, when we first... The first games we ever played was StarCraft 1, and we used to play at work all the time.
Oh, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't ever play those types of things.
Yeah, lots of people used to play it over at SCO2, and it was down in Santa Cruz. It was, you know, all the engineers would enjoy playing it.
And great game. Can you describe the game, one of you?
Yeah, it's a real-time strategy game. It's kind of a scrolling interface where you move around, and so it's a 2D dimensional game, and you have three different factions that you can play, and it's basically a simulated strategy war type game. Mm-hmm. Where you you build resources and develop your armies, and you know, there's lots of little bells and whistles of a sci-fi flavor twist to it.
Blizzard, the first game that I remember Blizzard doing was Warcraft. I'm sorry, it was Warcraft, the first one, where there's humans and orcs and they're fighting each other, and you decide what they do.
And that was sort of fantasy world counterpart, rather.
And then Warcraft 2 and StarCraft, I don't know if they came out around the same time, but they're both very similar to this idea that you have to manage how your minions and such are mining gold and water resources and all that.
And it sounds like Blizzard is going to stick to that same kind of overall theme. They're not going to do anything extremely fundamentally different with the new version. So, you know, tried and true.
And the reason why this, I mean, new games, especially second versions of of the original game, is a very common thing. But the reason why StarCraft is so newsworthy is that it's a very popular game that just sticks. So StarCraft 1, which was released, I don't know, we met in what,
1999, yeah.
It's been played since then, and it's still played all the time.
Actually, it was a little old by then, so it might have been
98. It was old by then, yeah. I remember just the last week, I saw somebody running Ubuntu with a touchscreen, and they switched into Wine, which is the ability to run Windows applications in Linux, and he was playing StarCraft to show off his machine and doing that using a touchscreen.
Oh, nice.
So StarCraft's still a pretty popular game for examples and everything.
Definitely.
Thank you very much.
And our former boss was actually a ranked competitor in StarCraft. Was it something like 50th in the world or something?
That's right. They did rankings. I think that's still going on too. Miles, the next story, sir.
There is a strange alien world that has water, except not in a liquid form. It's ice. The strange thing about it is that ice is 300 degrees Celsius.
What are you talking about? How can ice be hot?
Exactly. It seems like an odd thing, except that you have to remember, think of when you go to go hiking at high altitudes and you go to boil water. The water is not is boiling much sooner than it hits 100 degrees Celsius or 212 degrees Fahrenheit. It's going to be boiling at 150 degrees Fahrenheit or something like that. And it has to do with pressure. This happens to be a huge planet, an equivalent of 22 Earth masses. Therefore, even though it is very hot, it is still keeping the water icy.
Because of the pressure?
Yes.
Wow.
So you can, this would be something that would, this is ice that would vaporize you on contact.
So you would be able to take a match and stick it to this water ice and it would catch on fire?
No, you'd take a match about 3 miles away from it and it would catch on fire.
300 degrees Celsius?
300 degrees Celsius.
That's very hot.
That's hot, yeah. I mean, it's not white hot.
No.
Well,
It's not emanating heat.
Depends on what metal you're using. Yeah, okay.
Or ice for this in this situation. When does ice become? When can you take water ice and get hot enough such that it's radiating its own white temperature? That's a good question. Dark body.
Well, let's assume that it's a white color. So it could be some other color.
I would assume not a very friendly place for I don't know, life.
Well, who knows what type of life could arise, but. Yeah, nothing on Earth.
How'd they find this planet?
That's a fine question.
That's a big planet, but that's not that big. It's not even close to Jupiter or Saturn size.
It was found to be the smallest planet orbiting a distant star. In other words, for the most part, we've only ever found gas giants, but we found a few rocky ones. And what you're looking for is the wobble.
Of the nearby star.
Then once you can pinpoint it, then you start looking to see what the ultraviolet spectrum is, the light that's coming off of it, how it comes off. Different chemicals will have different signatures.
Okay, so how do they know that it's frozen hot ice? We're diving too deep into this story, huh? You don't know because you haven't read it all the way through. Is that true?
I don't know. They can determine that it has water at the same time, but that size, they probably just did the calculations and went, hey, this would be neat.
Have to be frozen. Real quick, one of the major ways we find distant planetary bodies orbiting the sun, the star. You're talking about the star as the planet orbits it actually shifts slightly according to the mass of the planet. And that's why we're able to find the larger planets, because they shift more.
Right. Imagine you had a ball and a tether, a tennis ball. You're just going to roll around. It doesn't have much effect upon you. If you make a bowling ball, however, you as you're swinging it are perturbed a lot more.
Right.
So what you're looking for is
and
a star
damaging that, your lower back, I'm assuming.
So you're looking for the star to have that wobble of having something swung around it through the force of gravity.
Speaking of being swung around the force of gravity, if you feel like you're getting tossed around a bit and you want some help, give us a call. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. GeekSpeak is supported by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Scotts Valley, offering computer rentals, printing, design, shipping, delivered office supplies, Notary Public, and more. Information is online at businesswithpleasure.com. You're listening to GeekSpeak, and we will welcome your calls with questions and comments of technology. We'll take anything today. We definitely have a Macintosh expert, a Linux expert, Unix expert, and a Windows expert. Of course, there's only three of us, so you have to do the math on that one. Stay tuned for Castle Cottage this morning after GeekSpeak at 11 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio KSP. This is Central Coast Public Radio KSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. You're listening to GeekSpeak. The geeks this morning are Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks, and we're taking calls with questions of technology. KOSP co-sponsors the 10th Annual Queer Youth Leadership Awards, presented in part by the Diversity Center in Santa Cruz. The celebration takes place on Saturday, May 19th at 6 p.m. Hey, that's today, at Harbor High School in Santa Cruz, and it includes a dinner, variety show, award ceremony, and community dance. For more information, please call 427-4004 or go online to QYLA2007. I'm assuming that's Queer Youth Leadership Awards 2007.org. And if you're interested in doing other things in Santa Cruz today, Santa Cruz is doing a whole retrospective boardwalk thing, and there's a great little family fair downtown Pacific Avenue, Pacific and Cooper Street. And you can go by there. There's actually a KOSP booth. There'll be live music today. And I saw Rob setting up, and Josh was there, and a whole bunch of people from KOSP. The big KOSP's vans there. And across the street is the business my wife helps run, Kids on Broadway. So a great thing for a family event. Ryder, I hope to see you there with your kid. GeekSpeak is supported by Henry J. Ramirez, DDS in Santa Cruz, specializing in cosmetic and family dentistry using digital technology for less radiation and offering one appointment, crowns and veneers. That means you can go into the appointment, he tells you you've got a cavity, he uses a 3D rendering machine in the other room and makes a tooth directly for you and pops it in, and you don't have to go away for a day and come back. It's kind of cool. For appointments and more information, 423-2447. That's Henry J. Ramirez, DDS, DDS in Santa Cruz. We're taking calls, questions, comments. Phone numbers are 476-2800. Again, 476-2800. We'll answer anything you throw at us. It just might be wrong. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP. Next news story is we wait for calls because there's no one on the queue right now.
No one on the queue. Okay.
Well, there is a question, though, that's come in.
Well, Ryder, you got another news story, right?
An interesting one. Dell has announced and provided snazzy little pictures of a prototype LCD monitor that uses a new interface called DisplayPort, which is a new high-definition interface, somewhat like DVI, which is the current digital video interface standard
for computers. It's a newer, wider display adapter in the back.
That's the DVI. Ultimately a high... and there's the ones that TV use, the HDMI. There is...
And I think HDMI and DVI have the same standard, but different interface.
Different cables. And the signals. HDMI is actually used more for the high-definition televisions and DVD players than probably for computers at this point. But the interesting thing about this DisplayPort is it's actually received a Visa industry standard certification, which makes it typically more widely adopted. So you may see the DisplayPort is going to be this kind of future port usage on monitors, at least.
And one of these current ones or a new one replacing DVI and HDMI?
They're kind of competing.
Okay.
So there's also UDI. You just keep throwing acronyms out. There's all these different standards. It's just a matter of whether or not they're really get implemented and adopted by the hardware vendors.
Now, one of the things I've noticed on DVI for the large screen monitors, and I'm not sure if this is because you need two cards to run these like 30-inch monitors, but you definitely need to use two DVI connectors. Is that one of the reasons why we need a new standard? Is because the resolution?
Well, I believe it's a bandwidth throughput, and it's dual link, I think, is the term that they use for DVI. And it's actually a throughput, and you can still have it through one port. I don't think you necessarily have to have two physical connectors into your monitor. I think there are some implementations that will do that.
That's in the spec. I don't think it's actually been implemented by hardware manufacturers. Yeah.
Okay, so then what's the point of a new connector type?
The interesting thing, this one is it's basically high speed, high bandwidth, and it's going to be supporting fiber optic cables.
Ah, that's a good reason.
Yeah, and one of the really cool things about this DisplayPort is you can actually daisy chain monitors. So instead of having a cable going straight from your computer in a star configuration from your computer to each monitor, you can attach it to one monitor and then daisy chain on additional monitors, and it's bidirectional communication and it's all high speed.
Wow.
Simplifies your wire. It's kind of like USB in the way it's laid out and daisy chain, but for screens, yeah.
Wow, I like that idea. Yeah. It'd be a wonderful environment when you are able to have a lot of people putting data on the line in one big monitor and be able to switch what you're viewing. And I guess fiber optic would be great also because, when you see almost all video screens for computers right now, you'll notice there's a big ball on both ends close to the connector. Mm-hmm. That's actually a ferrite bead that reduces the amount of noise that's being induced on the line.
Yeah.
Of course, with optics, you're not going to have any noise that's going to be induced magnetically, unless you get a really big planetary body moving fast. But that's not going to happen. Okay, Miles, what was the email question from Brad? You want to tell me about it? Ask us?
Well, it was just asking about conferencing software. He's on the road a lot, and so he was asking out of technology for a while, looking for conferencing software a la WebEx, WebEx being another type of conferencing software. My company had used GoToMeeting, which is obviously pay-for software. Alex brings up a program called SiteSpeed, site as in SIGHT, visual site, sitespeed.com, and says that one is free for personal use.
Cool. So that's the one they use. What about like Skype and all these other ones that are similar? They don't have a screen?
Skype is a voice. I don't know that it's visual.
Well, it's visual video, but this is more like sharing the screen kind of thing, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I don't think Skype handles that.
Yeah, sharing your desktop.
So again, the one that Alex recommends is sitespeed.com, and we really should put that up on the show notes at geekspeak.org. Let's go ahead and take a call from Santa Cruz. Stephanie, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hi. What's your question?
I had a question. I work on a Dell computer, and we predominantly produce documents, correspondence in Word, and I'm trying to, and they're, kept in subfolders with, say, a company or a client's name, and so, I've been asked to search, like, those correspondence, like, of a particular company name for a Word.
Okay. So there's a folder with all the email correspondence, any correspondence to a company. All the files are in one folder, and you want to search all those files for something inside the folder, inside the file.
In the way email. their Word documents and their, you know, correspondence, and they're each, you know, contained in a subfolder or like a folder for each client name. But I want to only search one particular folder, not the whole hard drive and not everything.
And what operating system are you using?
It's XP.
Okay. Well, and are you able to search in XP on this shared network connection stuff inside those files?
I'm able to search, but it's not...
But it's everybody.
It's everybody.
Okay.
It's like the entire...
So navigate to the folder that you want, and then do a find. And on the left-hand side, right? Am I right on this? You've got a Windows machine in front of you. Can't you specify only look from the current directory?
You can definitely navigate within a network drive. You can go down into a specific folder.
But then can you do a find from only that folder?
You should be able to, yes.
Can you test that right now?
Sure.
So have you had trouble doing this?
Yeah, I just noticed I was, you know, doing like a left click on the there's a, like a little tile thing, and so I'd be within that folder, and it has a search, but then it would start pulling up random documents that weren't Word.
Mm.
And it gives you the option to, like in the search, to say, you know, only spreadsheets or only, but it still looks like it's, I don't know if I'm just not clicking the right button.
I think the search interface for XP is pretty complicated. And the reason why I'm not able to clearly tell you exactly is that every time I do it, I have to kind of read through and figure out how to do it. There is a trick that you should know about when you, I think you can do an or search, meaning that you can say, I want to look in all files of this name, and I also want to look in inside the file for content like this, and then I also want to look only at this location. That the naming thing might be more useful than saying search only spreadsheets or search only documents.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, if you can choose the file name to search for, you use an asterisk, which is, you know, the shift 8,
right,
and a dot DOC for Word document, doc, and then it will only search in files that have a doc extension. Of course, that's not solving the only look from this location.
Right.
Ryder, can you walk us through?
Yeah, there is specifically, there's a look-in drop-down menu, and you have, you know, your My Computer, or you have your network.
Yes, yeah, under My Computer.
Yeah. At the very bottom, there's a browse. So you can actually go through, and it'll pop up a browse for a folder, and you can drill down through all of your hierarchy of whether it's... So this is specifically on a network drive, right? Or is this on your hard drive?
It's on the hard drive.
Okay, so it's on the hard drive. So you can drill down to a specific folder if you use that last option, the browse at the bottom.
So search, and this is under the heading search for?
It's a look in. It's a third drop down menu, or the third field in the search little tool on the left hand side.
So instead of it saying My Computer, you want to choose the browse option and then navigate to where you want to go to.
Yeah, there will be a few options there, but to get a complete picture, just use that little browse at the bottom, and you can go right down to the specific folder that you're looking for.
Stephanie, thank you so much for the call.
All right, thank you.
And thanks for listening to Geek Speak. You are listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. That was Ryder Brooks helping out on that question. We also have Miles Elam reading up on other questions. We'll take your question right now. The phone numbers are, well, and first off, there's nobody waiting, so you'd call in and you'd pretty much get in. Here are the phone numbers. Ready? 476-2800. Again, that's 476-2800. That's in the 831 area code. And then anywhere in California, you can call us toll-free, 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-KUSP, as in the cusp of California. Let's do one more news story while we wait for calls. Miles, it was kind of your turn. You ready for another news story?
Sure. Microsoft has announced that the current Vista desktop operating systems and their server-based operating systems, also known as Longhorn, will be the last 32-bit operating systems by Microsoft for their Windows line.
So the current Vista operating system is the last time they'll ever support Windows?
Last time they'll ever release a 32-bit version, which means that if you have a Pentium 4 or something that's just a 32-bit processor without the 64-bit extensions, you will not be able to upgrade to the new version. Then again, the new version will probably require something like 8 gigs of RAM.
But the new version meaning the next operating system after Vista?
Right.
So 10 years down the line? I mean, how long did it take Vista to come out? 5 years, right?
5 years after XP, right?
So five years from now, your computer that you bought 10 years ago will no longer be able to run a new version of Windows. I don't think it's a problem.
Wait, 5 years from now, the computer about 10 years ago?
Well, yeah, a machine that
you can still buy processors.
Oh, you can still
buy
processors. That's 32-bit. That's right. That don't have, I'm sorry, I was confused with the operating system installed. So what you're saying is, if you bought a new computer right now, in 5 years, you might not be able to get a new operating system from Microsoft for that computer.
Right.
So how
unless
somebody,
you bought a processor that had 64-bit extensions.
Do they tout 64-bit extension processors when they're selling machines at like Gateway and Dell and things of that nature? Is that a pretty common trait? And how much more expensive are they?
I don't know that Dell actually does that, because they're usually on their branding, the Inspiron versus, you know, things like that.
Well, how about this idea? How about you buy your computer now, it'll be the last Windows machine you buy, and then within 5 years, Ubuntu really will be ready.
Well, the thing is, how much do computers cost now? To buy it and try to figure out what you're going to do for a Windows version 5 years from now.
Right. Yeah.
Just well, keep in mind, this is just their server line. They're not saying that this is going to be for the client line.
No, this is for the desktop and the server.
They've clarified that this is actually only for the server line.
Which
is why it caused a big panic, because 64-bit computing is really not a big thing for the day-to-day user of computers, you know?
So Miles Ryder just totally trumped your story.
Yes, I am completely...
But you know what? I mean, this is the exact reaction that people had initially, is like, oh my God, this is going to be a big problem, because 64-bit technology is not really, as an industry standard, taking off yet.
Yeah.
There hasn't been a demand for it.
Well, there hasn't been a lot of support for it.
You have drivers...
Speak for yourself. In the Linux community, people have been gobbling up 64-bit like gangbusters.
So in the server environment.
Well, sure.
Because no one's... Okay, anyway, let's take a call from Santa Cruz. Norm, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hey, how are you guys?
Quite well. What's your question today?
Hey, well, lately, within the last couple of months, my Windows XP Dell computer has been constantly updating on shutdown, and it's usually only one update. And I've got Service Pack 2... And when automatic update is on, and it just seems really strange that all of a sudden it's every time this computer shuts down, it's updating.
It doesn't sound like it's succeeding at whatever it's trying to do. That'd be my guess. Have you tried running while your machine is running? Go ahead and do a Windows update manually. So you go to Start Programs Windows Update and run through that, and see if it does hang on something. And also, it might be that when you do it that way, it'll be more effective in achieving its goal.
How frequently do you actually shut down your computer? Do you do this nightly, or do you leave your system?
Oh, daily. Two or three users, and it happens with those guys, too.
Because they have been having a lot of updates lately. I've been noticing that on my PC, but if you're shutting it down every night, I wouldn't expect it every time to do that.
When you set up Windows Update to auto-do it when you're closing the machine down, doesn't it limit the amount of time of the updates? Doesn't it try to spread it out so that it's not doing a massive update right when it's shutting down?
Well, it will not download as you're trying to shut down. It will only install applications you previously downloaded.
So what's the solution? Do you like the idea of having him do it update manually and then see if something runs
into
a problem?
That's your best bet. I mean, because you really limit what you can see the system doing if you're allowing it to do it while it's in the shutdown process.
Right, it might say failed and then shut down and you don't even know.
I mean, personally, I'm very manual. I don't let it automate anything. I want to know exactly what it's putting on there so I can keep track of if something weird's happened to my system, what changed.
Well, right, you're a geek, though.
Yeah.
Norm, good luck.
All right, thanks.
Thanks for the call.
Bye.
From Monterey, Diane, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. I have a question about my virus protection, which is Norton virus. Uh-huh. And when it does its periodic, every few days or so, scan, it never finds anything.
That's good.
But is that normal?
Are you on a Windows or a Mac?
A Windows.
Okay. How much do you have a teenager in the house?
No.
Okay, then it's normal.
It's normal.
Do you browse the internet a lot?
Yeah.
Do you download applications and run them from unknown places?
Not generally.
Do you keep your Windows machine updated with Windows Update?
So.
Which browser do you use?
Internet Explorer.
Explorer.
Okay.
Uh huh.
And do you have a DSL connection or a dial-up connection?
DSL.
And do you have... So that means that you're going to have a router. Yeah, I think that's pretty normal, not having any virus. Do you want me to email you a virus and see if it's working for you?
I think I'll pass on that.
Pass on that?
But here's another quick one for you. I just thought maybe it wasn't working. It never detected anything.
Can I just indulge us for a second? You're calling us to say, hey, nothing's wrong. Is that true?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Okay, now
one thing I would like to point out, though, is make sure that your virus scanner has an online update. There are virus definitions that get updated all the time on a daily basis. You want to make sure that that is actually updating. It sounds like it probably is. Otherwise, maybe not. I mean,
Norton's pretty good about it. If it doesn't have current updates, it normally says it starts complaining to you, saying, "Hey, I'm not up to date."
It really depends on how old the software is.
Yeah, that's true.
How long have you had this, Diane?
Well, I've just been renewing it for the past.
Okay. Then you're fine. Okay, yeah. So next question we have. What was your second question? You had another issue?
Well, I don't know if you can go back and look up emails, but I sent you an email, and I don't remember what the topic was.
Do you remember when it was?
Yeah, April 21st.
Wow, April 21st. And you went to our website and filled out our form?
I did.
And, and I assume we didn't respond to you.
Well, no, it says, now let's hope that someone responds to you. So I didn't really, you know, I wasn't. But now that I've got you on the phone, I wonder if you can look up that email.
Sure.
Is that possible?
Yeah, what we'll do is Miles is looking it up right now. I'm going to go on to next question, and if we find it and can answer it, we'll totally answer it. So keep listening.
Fabulous.
Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Diane sounds like she doesn't have a lot of problems on her computer.
No.
Her virus is not, nothing's wrong with her virus protection. And she sends in a question about something not working, but she's obviously, it's not affecting her life too drastically.
Maybe we should have her and get a malware scanner, see what kind of real problems
she's
got.
Oh, I bet she'll find some cookies and all that stuff that's going on. Yeah. Do you think maybe her machine's totally infected and really things wrong? I would assume that Norton would detect
it. She would probably have some more complaints when she called in that things were, I think she's just, maybe she's not in a very aggressive or... internet surfer, you know?
Yeah, well, she definitely knows to call us, so she knows what's going on. Miles, have you found Diane's email?
No, but Alex did.
Ah.
But he hasn't
figured out what
it looks like
about.
The whole thing. It looks like it got truncated.
Well, we're still looking. Let's take, we're going to Atlanta, Georgia. Larry, welcome to GeekSpeak. Hello, Larry, you're on air. Oh, you know what? Larry's not on air. Larry, now you're on air. Hi.
Hello.
So you're calling from Atlanta, Georgia?
Yes, I am, sir. I'm sorry. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. What's your question today?
Question. Okay. What I have, my friend, is a whole bunch. Is a whole bunch of icons on my screen. In fact, I've got more icons than my screen has space for.
Oh yeah.
So you've been there before.
Oh yeah.
So what I'm looking for is, well, I'm looking for a program that will help me organize it, perhaps, so I can see everything I've got, or maybe we'll possibly. With a screen or something I could use to maybe organize it.
Okay, so there's another way to look at your desktop in what's called a list format.
Oh.
And I would recommend doing that because you'll see them just all listed. The other thing you can do is you can make another folder on your desktop, if you can do that, and you can move stuff into the folder. The icons are all going to work. There's a couple icons that won't move, but they'll give you an error anyway if you try to move them.
Okay.
And then you can kind of separate stuff. But you can do this in the list format. And the way you do that is you go to Start, Programs, Accessories, Explorer, Windows Explorer.
Okay.
And you can also, if you can find the icon on your desktop of your computer, my computer, you can just double-click that. In any case, that's going to come up with a screen of icons. And there's one of the toolbar items is a button, say, Folders. And when you click Folders, when you toggle it back and forth on the left-hand side, you're going to see everything about your computer, a whole bunch of different folders.
Mm-hmm.
The very top one of those that you click is going to be called Desktop. And when you click on that, on the right-hand side, all that icons and all that stuff is going to be there. And then you can change the view to be list or icons. And that's how I'd recommend taking a
peek. Do be aware that this is not going to change how it looks on your actual desktop. This is going to be a window folder representation of the same file. So it'll basically be the same listing but in a window. And that's what you can change the view on and sort by date, size of files, things
like
that.
An easy way to bring that up is the Windows key E.
Yes.
So you don't have to go through the Start, Programs, Accessories. Just Windows key E, and it'll pop
You're
up the
kidding
Explorer.
Me. Oh, I remember that. I used to remember that. So Windows key E pops up Explorer?
Mm-hmm.
Miles, that's great. Do you have another one of those gems?
Windows key L locks the screen.
Is that
when
good?
You're walking away. So
then
if you
have to remember your password?
Yeah.
Don't push that one. Jeez. People call up. You locked my computer.
There are a few other ones. There's like a shutdown one, too. I've forgotten. The one I use all the time is the Windows key E.
Which opens a new Explorer.
There's a Switch user one, too.
So the other thing I suggest, Larry, is set up your browser to download things not to your desktop but to a folder. Mm-hmm. So once you clean this thing up, make a new folder on your desktop, call it like downloads, then open up your Explorer or Firefox, whatever you use, and go into preferences and change the download folder to be that new folder. That way, as you get more stuff from the internet and it's always downloading on your computer, you can actually have it go into a folder, and then the folder will be on the desktop. When you double-click that, you'll see the contents of it, and you'll have a better interface on looking at the contents.
And there also are download managers that you can integrate into your browser that will actually, in addition to using a targeted folder for saving your files, it can actually sort them for you based on their content, what kind, you know, if they're compressed files or executables or text files. You guys know of any?
I don't know of any. I'm sure there's a Firefox extension for download manager that's a little more effective. What I do is I turn on Firefox and I say, always force me to suggest, you know, to tell you where to download things. And then I always choose a new location and kind of manage it. Larry, thank you so much for the call, especially since it was long distance for you. I really appreciate you calling in and asking this question.
Guys, thank you so much. Your information was so helpful.
Great. Take care. And from Santa Cruz, Ted, welcome to Geek Speak.
Hi there.
Hi. What's your question today, Ted?
A couple of questions about Windows Vista. First one is simply, you know, to Vista or not to Vista. Right. My instinct tells me, you know, wait 6 months or even a year, let them come out with a service pack or two.
You know, I have a little trick with Vista, and this is maybe pretty selfish of me. Every week, when it comes up, I ask the geeks in the room, "Are you running Vista yet?" And until they all say yes, I'm not going to switch. Miles, are you running Vista?
No, I'm not.
Written Vista?
Nope.
Writer's not either. I'm not either. Sean is, but he has to for work for testing stuff, so...
But on his main desktop, he doesn't.
Right. So don't do it. I think that's fair.
Well, I have a question. Yeah. I have a question for you. Are you thinking about a laptop or an actual desktop for running Vista?
Desktop.
And will you be upgrading to Vista, but not your computer? Your computer's going to stay the same. You just want to know if you want to make the switch?
Well, I'm asking sort of in general. I'm also a person that gets asked questions a lot. I don't think in many circumstances. So, your question leads to the next thing. Actually, I am way overdue for upgrading, and I think I'm going to get a G5 Mac, nice desktop, and you know, it's not that money is no object, but if I'm going to buy a new machine, I want to buy a good one that has expansion capacities of a tower rather than the iMac.
Right, they're actually not called G5 Macs, they're called Power Macs now because they've got an Intel chip.
Power Macs,
right.
Okay,
they're basically the Tower Macintosh. They're pretty expensive computers.
They are.
Yeah, I went through that recently because my mother was buying a new Mac, and we were trying to figure out what to buy, and the Mac Mini's not very powerful, and the iMac has this built-in screen, which you're going to want to use 5 years from now, but the computer will be too old. So what do you do? And I think we finally end up buying a Mac Mini. Even though it's a lot slower because it's so much better than what she has. Because the Power Macs, the old G5 case, the tower, they start at like $2,500. They're really expensive computers. So you're going to do that because you like the ability to upgrade.
Right. Well, and more RAM. It has more RAM slots. As I was looking at the Apple side, it seemed like the iMacs are limited to like, I see the 2 or 4 gigs of RAM.
Probably four.
That didn't seem, I mean, four is, okay now, but the other thing I wanted to do was use the boot camp and do dual boot. So my Power Mac would be my Windows machine and my Mac machine.
Now, are you a gamer?
No.
Okay, good. And the thing is that even the graphics cards in the Tower Macintoshes are not the top line graphics cards, and you can't upgrade them unless Macintosh supports the drivers and their operating system of that card. So there's some real limitations on buying a Macintosh tower for your, you know, supercomputer use. I'm back and forth. I use them at work. I mean, we do buy some machines that are kind of top notch. But if you're going to be doing a lot of Windows stuff, get a cheaper machine. Buy a Dell or something instead because you're going to save a lot of money. But if you're
Okay. Well, yeah. I over the years I've used mostly Windows, although I do love Mac.
The other option, of course, is you buy your Windows machine and then you try to hack Macintosh on top of it. And Ryder went through that recently, and it's definitely not ready for prime time, right, Ryder?
Correct.
So don't try to install Macintosh OS on top of a non-Mac computer unless you're just playing. It's not as a primary.
Oh, I see, right.
And if you want both and you're thinking about buying a new computer, then a Power Macintosh, of course, is a great choice. It's got some money attached to it.
As far as Vista, I'd really wait till there's a service pack that comes out for it. There's lots of little itty bitty problems with it. Small file transfers from copying files tends to be a bit longer than people would want. There have been some on laptops. Even though the reason why I asked you this question is that the new Aero Glass interface is kind of 3D hardware intensive, and that for laptops that actually incurs an additional battery drain that normal XP systems don't have. So you would actually get slightly lower battery life than if you had a Windows XP on the same laptop. So there's little things like that need to be worked out. You know, it's a fresh operating system, and a lot of people are making a lot of noise about it. And if you have the patience for it, I would probably recommend just kind of waiting and see how it all irons out.
Thank you, Larry, for the call.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sorry, Ted, thank you for the call.
Yep, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, we're going to take one last call today from Tom. And Tom, you're in Santa Cruz. What's your question today?
Yeah, hi. Hey, I'm pretty new at this. I downloaded Google Earth. And then when I see the terrain in the cities and stuff like that on the planet, then as I zoom in to California, it's okay. And then when I zoom into Santa Cruz, then all of a sudden it starts going blank in spots, like certain sectors, and then random irregular triangles keep popping up all over. And then I get closer,
Yeah, the reason that's happening is that those bumper stickers that say "Keep Santa Cruz Weird," Google Earth can't handle that.
it's the mystery spot.
It's the mystery spot too, right?
I tried that.
Yeah, what's happening is you're running into a driver incompatibility problem with what Vista's trying to do with what Google's trying to do with the 3D stuff and what your card can handle. Sean would say right away, update your drivers to your graphics card, which is fine. There's also two ways to launch Google Earth. When you go up to the start menu, look through Google. Are you running on a Windows machine?
Yeah.
Yeah. When you go start and go up to Google Earth folder, there's actually two ways. There's two other applications, set to OpenGL and set to DirectX. You can try those two different versions and see if OpenGL works better for you. It's going to try to install, I think it will try to install DirectX if it assumes that your graphics card is powerful enough or something. But you would try setting those two things differently. It might be that one of them doesn't work at all. So this next thing is, when you're running Google Earth, and if you've got a computer that's newer than 5 years or newer than 3 years, go to Google and click on the little more link and go get Google Earth. You can do a Google search on Google Earth. Get this application and play with it, especially if you have broadband. It's an amazing experience. It's a 3D model of the Earth. You can zoom down and see cars anywhere on the planet.
It's called Google More?
I'm talking to everybody right now. You already have Google Earth, so you've already got running into the problems that everyone else is about to run into if they follow my directions. So try starting it with OpenGL or DirectX. And then the next thing is, before you zoom in to Santa Cruz, over on the left-hand side, kind of on the bottom, there's a whole bunch of checkboxes on different things you can have on and off.
Right.
Turn off everything and then zoom in. Because what's happening is some of those items are like shared content from other people. And it's possible that one of those shared contents is a 9,000-story building in Santa Cruz. Because anybody can make content and kind of add to it. And you don't necessarily want to download that because there might be problems in that file. And that's what Google Earth is having trouble with. So unclick all those. If you still have the problem, then update your drivers. And you know what? We're running out of time and I talk too much because I'm too excited about Google Earth. Thank you so much for the call.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. The Geeks this morning were Miles Elam and Ryder Books. Geek Speak is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto. We're streaming and online podcasting at kosp.org. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. The Geeks this morning, Miles Elam and Ryder Brooks, thank you so much for being here today, guys.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
And answering the phone was Rick Fellman. Thank you, Rick, as every week. Thank you very much. And to all that called in and even listened to GeekSpeak, thank you so much for making GeekSpeak what it is.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available real-time traffic alerts. More at Acura.com/RDX.